interviewing Mrs. Bess Rosenberg, 422 Rancho Drive. Dates November the 18th, 1975. Okay, Mrs. Rosenberg, when did you come to Las Vegas?
I came here in the winter of 1942.
Okay, why did you come here?
My husband came here. He was employed here at that event. He came in 1941. I followed the early part of 1942. And the town was certainly a great deal different then. It seemed like the town ended about 6th Street. There was no paving. And there was the one hotel on the strip, the El Rancho. And the strip was a little two-lane highway with a lot of dirt on each side of it. So when they did put in a big highway, they didn't have anything disturbed. There was nothing there but dust and dirt and probably some bushes, some tumbleweeds or something like that. But there was it was a wide expanse of nothing with this little two-lane highway out to past the, oh, I would imagine where that fork in the road is now, where it's, down by the post office, anyway. That isn't Twain, that isn't Twain.
Maryland Parkway?
No, it's the road that leads from the strip west. And I can't think of the name of the little street now, anyway. But about from there on, it was all just highway. And some of the things I remember in the later years is we had settled here and we bought our first home, and where the Frontier Savings is now, in that triangular flat iron shaped lot that is bordered on one side by East Charleston and the other side by about Garces or one of the gas down in there. Anyway, that on the exact site where the Frontier Savings is, there were electrical transformers that carried the power for Las Vegas. And I said, you know, I'd like to my husband, I'd like to have that triangular piece of property. I think that it's distinctive looking, and he just put up a nice store there sometime. And he said to me, way out here? In the world of drive clear out here, which is just how far-sighted some of us were not. And then as we're having the delay of the nuclear explosions here, reminds me of a few funny, well, exactly funny, but informative things about the first atom bomb. And at that time, they called it Jackass Flats, where they had the detonation. And I was working the swing shift in one of the hotels as an entertainer, and went to work at 9, worked till about 3 in the morning. So, the slack season, when there wasn't too much doing, and it was this type of weather from about 1 to 3, there wasn't too much business. So we would sit around and visit, and we had come to the hotel, 3 or 4 gentlemen, and I understood that it's hard to keep a secret in this town anyway, that there were 3 or 4 at all the hotels. At that time, there were about 4 or 5 hotels. And they had stationed each one, 4 or 5 in each hotel, thinking that it would cover up their real purpose in town, which was some of them were newspaper men, some were scientists, and to cover the detonation of the first atomic blast. Well, they had had one before at an Alamogordo, but they wanted to test this one here. So at that time, I became acquainted with Bob Considine. All these gentlemen would come down with their heavy, heavy sheepskin coats on and hats with little ear flaps on them and everything. And you couldn't help but find out after a while what they were doing here. But it was supposed to be a big secret. So anyway, just before the big blast, Walter Winchell found out about it somehow, and he printed something in the paper. Well, it frightened the citizens of Las Vegas of his fear. So immediately they brought out a very famous PR man, I can't remember his name, escapes me too at the time, came out to try and do a some kind of a informative interview with different scientists of the AEC to tell the people that the people of Las Vegas, that if their windows were going to be broken and their mirrors were cracked and everything, that to pay no attention to us, that it was in the line of defense. Well, this gentleman had a terrible hard time, the thing to do, because once people had become alarmed by the Walter Winchell radio broadcast, they turned deaf ears to anything they would say about how harmless the first blast was going to be. So this fellow was very, very busy around there, and it got so that they would laughingly say, well, I think we're going to set off a firecracker in the morning. So anyway, this one morning it seemed like everything, they had made many trips up there in the cold, cold weather, and they'd come, there would be no detonation, they'd come back, another time they decided to change. I guess the winds, as it is today, when the winds are heavy, they won't detonate those blasts, even though these were not underground. So anyway, this fellow was talking about, he said, I think we're really going to have one in the morning. So I said, oh, fine. He said, now I'm telling you like I tell everybody else, don't turn around and face that way. Oh, I said, no, goodness sakes, I wouldn't want to do that. He said, the sky will light up. Nobody should look that direction. So I said, all right. So by the time I got home and my dad got up, and we were having breakfast, and you couldn't help but see it, but I didn't mean it the way it sounded when I went to work that night. Dick Porter, that was the fellow's name, came in, and he said, well, did you see our little firecracker? I said, well, I don't know how you could miss it. I was sitting in the kitchen looking out the window, just exactly what he told everybody not to do, but I really wasn't looking right at it, just that you couldn't, and the sky was so bright. I've never seen such brilliance. And there were windows broken and mirrors shattered, and for many years after that, people, when they would have cracks in their ceiling, and whether they were caused by the successive blasts we had, they would always say, well, we didn't have that crack in the ceiling until we had the atomic bomb out here. So then I don't know how many more we had after that, but the first one I remember after that, I sure looked the other way, but I couldn't, I just wasn't thinking, and he looked at me with utter disgust after I said it, and I knew I said the wrong thing, but I really wasn't looking out the window, it was just that I was facing in the direction where it happened that way. So, and then my husband and I became very friendly with a gentleman by the name of Dr. Ralph Carlisle Smith, who was here quite a long time. In fact, I think he married a Vegas girl, or some girl that was working here. And he was an atomic scientist who had a degree in law and a degree in medicine and physics. He was just fantastic. And he had helped Dr. Lilienthal write the book on atomic warfare, which I think later was issued to all troops that were in any way connected with the use of, atomic submarines and the weapons and missiles they had on there. That was their guidebook, one of the first ones. And of course, as you became, progressively friendlier, he became Smitty. So we were talking rather one night, and someone said that they didn't know who he was. And they said they thought Smitty was so much fun. I said, yes, he is. And of course, he said, I wonder what he does for a living. I said, well, I really don't know. And they said, don't you think he ought to try for a career in show business? He was a comparatively young man, but he was so witty and so funny. And it struck me so much, because here's a man with all these degrees and everything, and his relaxation was, he was really quite a pundit. He was a funny man. But, I made lots of friends in those days, but of course you lose track of them. But Las Vegas was a very small, friendly little village. And I know that the wheels of progress must turn, but sometimes I look back and think of the warmth and the friendliness and everything. It was something to remember with great fondness.
Where did you entertain us?
Well, I worked at the Last Frontier. When it was the Last Frontier, there was the Ramona Room. And then in the big room, they had, I think, Elvis Mabee's first appearance there, and Shecky Green, And we had Freddie Martin, and Merv Griffin was the pianist of Freddie Martin at that time. And then Liberace, that was his first introduction to Las Vegas. So I would be, while they would be playing, of course, Liberace for many years has played the Bear Bell Polka. While he was playing it in one room, I was playing it in the other. And also with Merv Griffin, when then the next time Freddie Martin came back, he also had a Las Vegas resident who still is working here, I believe, at the MGM, Murray Arnold. Murray was with Freddie for a long, long time. But those, as I tell you, Jerry, those were the... I have many fond memories. The good old days, yeah.
What were you saying about if you sang while you played the piano?
Well, you asked if I sang. Well, in those days, they had an entertainment. They had passed a bill. But you could have a pianist. That was all right. But if there was any singing, you had to pay a 20% tax, entertainment tax. So all of the hotels that had lounge entertainment would not let you sing, because they didn't want to pay the tax. And in those days, of course, it was, who's ever heard of an entertainment tax? So any, the singing that was done very late in the morning when you figured that the spies weren't out somewhere. So anyway,